Hello folks and welcome back, and if you're a new listener, welcome to the show. I'm your host Simon Ward and you're listening to the High Performance Human Podcast. Now you might not realise this, but you are a high performance human. It isn't just about your fitness level and your race results. It's not even about how you compare with other endurance athletes. Being a high performance human is about your whole life performance. Sleep, nutrition, exercise, relationships and mental health. And you don't have to be a high-level athlete to excel at any or all of these. We appreciate that you might think you've still got room for improvement, and if that's the case, then we'd love to help you. I've currently got availability to take on a couple of clients, and my wife Beth, who's a certified life coach, also has some availability. So, depending on what you're looking to focus on, we've got you covered, and you can find details in the show notes below. Now, before I introduce today's guest, I'd like to give a big shout out to Jamie Walker and his dad, Richard, who I met at the pool the other morning. We were chatting and then Richard said, "Oh, I recognise your voice. Are you Simon?" And he said, "I listen to your podcast regularly. So thank you guys for listening. I do appreciate your support." Okay, here's a question for you. Have you ever heard of Lucy Gossage? That's Dr. Lucy Gossage. She's been around on the long distance triathlon scene for a while. And when she was racing, she was instantly recognisable with her blue Erdinger kit, running peak and infectious smile. And if you don't know Lucy, she's got 14 Ironman victories to her name, including Ironman UK, Ironman Wales, Ironman Lanzarote and Patagonia Man. Basically, all the tough ones. 2019, she stepped back from Ironman racing to focus more on her work as a cancer doctor in Nottingham. Now you'll get a sense of how Lucy likes to challenge herself when you hear our conversation and reflect on that race resume. So today's chat is all about another of those challenges, and they really don't come much bigger than this, the Winter Spine Challenge. 268 miles on the Pennine Way in the depths of winter. As you'll hear, it's a non-stop event requiring participants to be self-sufficient. The temperature barely gets above 0 degrees C. There's often knee-deep snow and blizzards on the top of the hills. And on top of all that, there's sleep deprivation that can quite literally be a nightmare. Anyway, I don't really want to tell you the whole story, so let's crack on and hear it all from Lucy. Welcome back, Lucy Gossage. Lovely to have you here again.
Thanks for having me on.
You're in a slightly different place to normal at the moment.
Yeah, I'm back in Mallorca. Having great holiday, pretending to do a bit of triathlon again, and yeah, some running adventures, and yeah, just having a bit of downtime, which is nice.
Have you completely left triathlon racing behind you now, or is it just a temporary absence?
No, I'm going back to Nice this year. Got my pro card again, and going back to Nice
to race in the Ironman France or the World Championships.
No, of course I haven't. People, like, Nikki was trying to wipe people up. You were like, "Oh, that's a coup."
It is, yeah. I'm thinking that's very good. So, and it's not April the 1st either. So, have you left triathlon behind,
yeah,
apart from hanging out with your friends?
Yeah, I never swim. Although I am swimming here because it's so lovely. It's an outdoor pool. But yeah, no, I'm completely done with triathlon. Still love running, biking, and still love swimming if it's outside. But yeah, definitely those days are in my past.
it did when I was writing down some topics for us to chat about and asking you about your triathlon sort of involvement now, it did make me think, yeah, I know that swimming was never your main love. And so the opportunity to not have to do it every week probably is a joy.
Do you know what I love? I do actually love the process of swimming. I just and until COVID, I was continuing to swim, but it's the faff of it. It's the having to find a. If I had a 25 or 50 meter outdoor pool at my house, I would probably swim four times a week because I do really enjoy it. I find it really relaxing. I didn't like the process of it and being so kind of dependent on the clock because I wasn't very good at it, and it just. That made it stressful. And it was the fact that I used to swim at 5:30 in the morning. So it was as a triathlete, it was always the bit that I liked least. But actually now, I did a couple of K this morning just because the pool was there and it's just nice, isn't it?
I have a client who has a house by the sea. And when I went to stay with him, we were cycling every day. And I said, "Come on, we should go and swim every day." And he said, "Oh, I only swim two or three times a week." And he keeps reminding me now that I said to him, when this is 50 yards from your back garden. Why wouldn't you swim every day? It's 25 degrees. It's like Hawaiian water. So, you know, you can go in. It's a pleasure to swim around. You can look at the fish, have half an hour every night. And it's just nice to do that as a sun's setting.
Yeah, no, I think I only swam twice this year. So I've probably done twice last year. So I've probably done about three times as many swims this year already. But anyway.
And of course, you sort of retired from racing as a pro triathlete to not to take up, but to continue more with your academic work and your research work. How's that all going?
It's not academic. So I'm an oncologist. So I work in Nottingham, treat testicular cancers, so germ cell tumours and sarcomas. So work as a doctor, basically seeing patients, and then do a lot of work with Move Against Cancer charity, not paid work, but kind of passion project work. I don't think I retired to do that. So actually, my last couple of years of triathlon, I was working part time and competing part time professionally, and then I retired at the end of 2018 properly. And then had kind of 3 months off work completely before I started my consultant post. But a lot of my career I was working as a doctor. I do really enjoy it, actually. You realise when you're away that you do love your job despite the stresses of it.
And, you know, obviously you were right there in the middle of it. And like most people in the sort of medical world, it was all hands to the pump. But how have you found that things have changed since the pandemic?
I think it's fair to, and I've written quite a lot of blogs and articles about this, actually, because it's something I feel really strongly about. I think the NHS is in a really bad place at the moment, and it's made up of really good people trying to do their best in a system that's not working very well. I think COVID obviously put a massive spanner in the works, but we haven't caught up yet. But nearly everyone working in the NHS is doing it for the right reasons, and that's what kind of carries it through. I have written quite, you know, if anyone's interested, go to my website, because I have written quite a few blogs and articles about my perspective on it. And I guess in some ways my time out kind of helped me reflect a little bit more, because when I was a junior, it was just really different when I was a junior doctor, and as a doctor you're much more part of a team, and now the juniors do have a really tough time, and it's not as fulfilling a job, I don't think. And I think the thing that most people in the NHS would say they struggle with is not being able to offer the service they want to despite their best efforts. But fundamentally, I do still really like my job, and I like being able to call out the nonsense.
That's great. And, you know, I've not had many interactions with the NHS, but the ones I have had over the years have given me that same belief that you've just mentioned there, that ostensibly you've got a group of people who are trying to do their best. They're passionate about what they want to do. But, you know, the environment that they're working in, because of the financial considerations and everything else, just makes it more of a struggle, and like you say, more recently means that they're not able to offer the service and care that they would like to do, I think from what I've read, and you might be able to explain more, that's also affecting their mental health as well, not just because of the stresses they're under, but also the fact that they're going home feeling like they're not able to do what they should be, and they're leaving people, you know, in corridors uncared for at times.
I think A&E is a really tough place to work at the moment, I don't know what the answer is there, you know, definitely money, but it is also badly managed. So, you know, there's a lot of inefficiencies. There's a lot of nonsense. There's a lot of nonsense that goes on in the NHS. Fundamentally, I still, you know, I love working with people who I see at their strongest every day. And that's, you know, that's what kind of keeps me going.
Well, and I think if we all have the appreciation that the majority of people that work in the NHS have got that same passion and care that you have, Lucy, then we're in good hands.
Yeah, I think so. I think that is really true. And everyone is trying, you know, and this is goes from the people that do the cleaning to the porters to their healthcare assistants to the admin staff who are at the end of the phone when someone's saying, I still haven't got my appointment for my CT scan. Like, they're the unsung heroes. We're kind of consultants, so they're the face of the NHS, but it's actually all the people behind the scenes that make a difference. And, you know, if I want a CT scan, I will nip round to CT and talk to the ladies that work in the booking department and say, look, I'm really, is there any way you can squeeze in these CT scan? And you know, they do their best. So it's actually all the people behind the scenes that make a massive difference, but probably don't get thanked for it as well.
Okay, let's move on to other things then, Lucy. You recently completed the spine, the winter spine. I make a distinction there because there are two, and we'll probably can talk about the two. I'll let you explain to people who aren't yet familiar with what the spine challenge is. Go on, tell us what the spine challenge is.
So the spine is the craziest thing I've ever done. So it's the length of the Pennine Way. So it's, I think they say it's 268 miles. It's slightly different each year. Non-stop. So the clock doesn't stop when you stop. By foot in winter, in January. So you've got about 8 hours of daylight a day. So you set off from Edel. You finish at Kirkgeltham in Scotland. You have to carry everything so that you're self-sufficient on the trails if you needed to bivvy out there. So you have to have a bivvy bag, sleeping bag, a mat, a stove, kind of lots of, I think there's 32 items on the kit list. So you've got a moderately heavy pack. It's maybe, I think mine was about 8 kilos when it was fully loaded with food and water. They say it's a running race. It starts running, it finishes shuffling, stroke crawling, stroke walking, stroke hobbling. And there are 5 checkpoints along the way where you can sleep and get hot food and change your kit, etc. So you have a drop bag, 20 kilo bag that gets carried from checkpoint to checkpoint. So you can kind of change your kit and things. So yeah, absolutely bonkers.
And the reason I was making the distinction there, because there is a summer spine challenge that follows the same route, isn't there?
So summer spine is exactly the same, but it's in summer. Slightly less kit list, but actually I think that has probably got similar challenges, very different challenges, but water, you need to carry a lot more fluid obviously if it's hot. I think last really because hot water and socks and things is actually really bad for feet. So yeah, it's kind of, I viewed it as one massive jigsaw puzzle of stuff that I'd never kind of really done before to try and find a way to do this puzzle as quickly as possible.
And there is a half distance as well. I can't remember what that one's called.
So there are two. So there's the first 100 miles is a race, and then the second 160 miles is a race. So they have a challenger south and challenger north. And they also have, they call it a sprint, and it's 50 miles. Wow. So that's the first stage.
Wow. So, I mean, that sounds like, to me, that sounds like a horrendous, but also just monumental challenge, certainly different to a 10-hour Ironman race. What on earth prompted you to take that on?
Oh, it was a very long, very long journey to the start line, actually. So I first heard about it very randomly when I was still a pro triathlete, and I got invited on Women's Hour. And they wanted to talk about whether it should be Ironman or Ironwoman. But the reason they were talking about that was because an incredible lady called Jasmine Paris had just won the spine race outright. So she'd beaten all the men, and she'd done it whilst she was expressing milk for her, I don't know, 12-month-old baby or something. So they invited me on to kind of talk about my opinion. And I heard about the spine race, and Jasmine was all over the news. And I was like, oh my God, that is crazy. Like, no one would want to do that. Like, can you imagine traipsing through the mountains in January and not sleeping? And but I think that was the first kind of seed that got planted. And then then it was just kind of a journey over the last 3 years, really. My former partner and I did a lot of, so we kind of entered it together, and we did a lot of training together. It kind of turned from really little, like little by little, from being something that I really didn't want to do to something that a bit, very much like Ironman, was like, that's impossible, to them thinking, well, actually, is it impossible? And then kind of we are one of the first holidays that we did just after lockdown was very impromptu. We couldn't get an Airbnb in Wales. And just found a walk across Wales. Andrew was like looking, you know, looking for stuff to stay. And he's like, oh, there's this route across Wales. Should we just do that instead? So we ended up walking across Wales. And I was still really fit at that time. So that was 2021. So I was still a good runner. And I was like, yeah, of course, how hard can a walk across Wales be?
I was walking. Big mistake.
It was so hard. We were probably doing, I don't know, probably averaged like 28 miles a day. But oh, like my feet were a mess and it was so hard. But that was kind of the start of loving it. I've done cycle touring, but really loving point-to-point exploring by foot. And it's so different to cycle touring. You see so much more because you're going more slowly. There's something so incredibly satisfying about just having everything you need in a bag on your back and setting off and going from point to point to point to point. And that really kind of started it. And then the more of that we did, the more, you know, I listened to a few podcasts about the spine and I started to get sucked in. And I can remember exactly the podcast that I listened to. I was like, I'm so going to end up doing this. So that's kind of, it was a 2.5 year journey really to the start line.
And in that interim period between that walking Wales and sort of starting to, and that Woman's Hour program, had you started to immerse yourself in the ultra world by doing any shorter events?
No. So I think the Woman's Hour was probably like 2018 or something. No, it must have been 2019 after Jasmine had won. And then, so it was 2 years later that we did the walk across Wales. And we did do the lap. So the lap was like a 50 mile race again, just as a challenge. And I won it. So I was still quite a fit runner, and actually it transpires, I think walking across Wales is the perfect training for running 50 mile because we were so strong. We sent everyone off on the wrong way by the first 15 runners. It was hilarious. We just ended up like we were at the front of, there were 15 people or 20 people ahead of us. We sent the whole race the wrong way and then ended up right in the back, kind of going, anyway, that was good fun. But yeah, I did that. But other than that, I didn't do any races. It's not really about racing. And the spine, I know it was a race, but it wasn't a race against anyone else. It was a challenge for me to see what I could do.
Okay, so let's start by talking about the stuff that most people like to know about. It's essentially a speed hike, really, isn't it? At times, it's just a keep going type of hike rather than a running event. What does your training look like for that event? Because there's no way you can do that amount of footwork in a week to make you feel like you're ready. So
I would say for the first 48 hours, I was running the downhills, shuffling the flats and walking the uphills, but the uphills, like, you know, any little gradient I'll be walking, but I was doing a reasonable chunk of running for the first 48 hours, and I think we went through the 100 miles in 27 hours, which actually with those kind of packs it's not a bad time for a 100 mile race, and then the slower you go, you know, the longer you go the more walking there is. But actually running does break up kind of the burden on your feet. So trying to kind of shuffle some of the downhills is, it definitely makes it easier. So training, I mean, I don't know how you would train for something like that. But for me, it was always about the adventure. So we did a lot of point to points, so trips. So we kind of did Offersdyke, coast to coast. We'd done the Pennine Way. We did the Dragon's Back route, which is across Wales. So we've done that a couple. So loads and loads of just holidays, like cycle touring, but by foot. And then I made myself, when I entered in January last year, I was like, right, if you're going to do this, you need to do two gym sessions. A session once a week.
What was the other one? Two gym and
a yoga, but it's kind of a power yoga, strength yoga. It's what you remember, Lou Bates, Lou Collins.
Yeah,
she runs them. You can imagine Lou Collins, beast, bike beast, yoga beast. They're not relaxing yoga sessions. Anyway, they were like my, they were the only bits that I would say is training, because I just knew that I had to get as strong as I could. And then, yeah, so I did a lot of point to points, a lot of long days in the hills. And then other than that, just commuted, did a bit of biking still. In particular, in the summer, I kept the biking going. Not high level, but I still love biking.
So did you do much running at all during the week?
Yeah, so I run, and I haven't driven to work in 4 years. So I'm in the hospital 3 days and then work at home one day. So I tend to cycle my stuff in on a Monday, then run home Monday night, run in and back Tuesday, run in Thursday. And these, you know, the runs could be anything from shortest is 5.5 miles. The longest I think I did was 22 miles in. So yeah, I'll do what I'm feeling. But I didn't have a plan. It was just kind of commuting, the gym sessions, riding when it was nice weather, and then big days in the hills.
And how does that feel, not having a plan to train, just doing what you feel like? I guess that when you were training for triathlon, you had a much more structured schedule.
Yeah, I did, but I still found ways to keep it fun. So I still did a lot of kind of fun. I rather than doing intervals, I might do fartleks between a village that you ride really hard between a village and things. Actually, I would say because I'd had 4 years since I'd done triathlon. So actually this year I almost had a focus again. So I had a reason to train, which I liked. I think before I'd still did loads of stuff, but there was no reason for it other than to be fit for adventures. So yeah, I like having a goal again. I have this jigsaw puzzle in my head, because it's people, you know, we're talking about fitness, but there's so much more than fitness. And it's about the kit, it's about how you look after your feet, it's about how you manage niggles. Because if I've learned anything, is that if you do a multi-day thing, the niggle you have on day one is gone by day two. You've then got something else, and that's gone by day three. And it's how you manage all of that, how you manage pacing, like poles. So I bought poles, and how you use poles, and there for me they're a game changer. And being out at night, so we did things like ran through the night. We did do a 100-mile race as a kind of practice, tiny little race in the Peak District, but I felt like I needed to know that I could do 100 miles before I did the spine race. Ice, snow, temperature, nutrition, all of that. It was this jigsaw puzzle.
So there's a couple of things here. I've done Marathon des Sables a couple of times, and I've helped a few people prepare for it. I've got one guy I'm working with now that's doing the Dragon's Back this summer.
Yeah.
That you mentioned. That's a multi-day event. And whenever I've chatted with folks like that and they're always worried about their fitness, my comments are, you won't be worried about your fitness. It's the other stuff that's going to sideline your hygiene, foot care, particularly in the desert, foot care, particularly when it's wet, foot care, you know, just stomach issues. On an event like yours, sleep deprivation and how you deal with that sort of thing. And I'd like to come on to that in more detail. So, and equipment choices. And I think, again, I hear a lot of guys that are doing the shorter ultra saying, I don't need poles, I'm never using them. Yet when I spoke to Jason Koop, who's written one of the world's leading ultra running preparation books, he is a firm advocate of using poles. And he says to me, I have much more difficulty persuading the guys to use poles than I do with the ladies.
Well, no, I love my poles. When we got them last March, and as soon as I got them, I was like, oh my God, these are a game changer. Cause they just, they say it, like when you're tired, they save all your stabilizing muscles. They're really good for getting up the hills. I think you need to be fit. So my guess would be that my heart rate's probably higher when I'm using them.
Yeah.
But my legs are being saved. So I'm like, I love, I mean, I'm really bad technically. People don't believe quite how bad I am technically. I am really bad technically. I've got better, but I'm still a complete granny. And the pole just helped me loads with that.
And I think also, you know, you sort of alluded to it there. When you're tired and you're going downhill and you've sort of lost some of the motor control around your hips and your knees, and that sort of just, the last thing you want to do is slip and hurt something. So having that third point, like a tripod for the pole, is a, like you say, it's a game changer, is it? And I remember quite a long time ago, one of my clients was coming to his 60th birthday and he wanted to do the Three Peaks. And as we were going downhill on the final descent, he was really struggling with his balance. And that was when I realized that poles would have made a massive difference to him just in that final bit, in confidence and just making sure he put his feet in the right place.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been taught how to use them, but as soon as I think the first time I use them, actually, we're doing something, there's something called the Kinder Challenge. You go up Kinder Scout, there's 12 different routes up. And by the kind of third ascent and descent, I just felt like I was natural with them. I guess, you know, other people don't kind of feel that they give them as much, maybe if they're better technically or they just kind of don't. I don't know. For me, they just feel second nature. And I use them from Mar 1 straight out of EDL. I was like, right, not getting rid of these.
What's interesting as well is if you ever watch any of the documentaries about Kilian Jornet and some of those mountain runners, when they're doing some of those big events, they're nearly always using poles. I mean, you know, when you talk about being technically good, Kilian Jornet is about as good as they come in being sure-footed and confident.
Yeah, and we had, you know, we had a lot of snow and ice, so grip was a real issue. But actually, when, you know, mud, if you're running on really muddy stuff, like they can save so much energy trying to stay up, and stuff that you'd normally be, you know, in the UK, you get that really slippy, wet mud that's just horrible. You can't run over that, and you're kind of like shimmying over. And poles, I just, for me, they're a game changer. And
I really like the bit you said there about doing the yoga and the gym sessions and making sure that they were a priority. I don't know how much did they feature in your triathlon training on a regular basis?
With hindsight, I wish I'd done more, actually. I really wish I'd done more. So Lou used to do yoga, and I was like, I haven't got time for this. And it always felt like it was an effort. And I was like, I'm not flexible. I'm rubbish at it. I'm not flexible. And yoga is not really about flexibility. It's about strength. And a lot of her stuff is core or single leg stability and hip flexors and all that stuff that you need for running. And yeah, I've had, you know, over the last 3 years, I've literally had every injury you could possibly have. I've sprained both my ankles. So I knew I had strength in my ankle, my proprioception. I've had knee issues. I've had, I don't know, literally every kind of issue that you could possibly have. And I just think that I'm not invincible, but I'm stronger than I used to be, but not kind of heavy lifting weights, but just more durable, I think.
I think that's the important point to get across for endurance athletes is it's very difficult to gain muscle, even if you were lifting heavy weights when you're doing all of that endurance work. But B, it's, you know, the more elite coaches I've spoken to from different sports, the more they talk about strength training and the mobility helps make sure that the athletes can turn up for the key training sessions on a more regular basis, and then that builds consistency, and we all know that consistency means ultimately, you know, a better chance of achieving your goals.
Yeah, and last year we did a night run on New Year's Eve, actually, just for fun before entering the spine. We set off at 10 o'clock, set off at 5 o'clock, ran till 9, had a Thai takeaway, sat in a posh dinner because the chip shop was closed, and then kept running till 3, and it was brilliant. But I sprained my ankle 5 miles into that. So I started January with this ballooned, like a pretty bad sprained ankle. But after that, I was super consistent. I think I had 3 days off for another little niggle that came out of nowhere, and other than that, just kind of nothing. But I didn't do any speed sessions I was really chuffed with that.
Very good. So interesting, the sort of more of a freestyle type of training thing, lots more fun stuff. Although I know anybody who really knows you, Lucy, will know that you like to make it fun. They only have to look at your face when you're doing it to see that.
I would say, Simon, that I think they I did freestyle it, but I think so many people overcomplicate stuff. And actually, you know, for the spine or even for triathlon, until you've got the basics really right, that you don't need to worry about if you're doing 5 by 6 minutes or 6 by 4 minutes. It's all nonsense. Brilliant. You need to do a bit of hard stuff and a lot, but I think you can overcomplicate stuff. And for me, I guess the other thing I'd say that I didn't mention is from September, I started training with a pack. So got a heavier, because I'd done a lot of running with kind of 4 kilo packs. I think when we did Wales, it was maybe 6. But from September, I made sure I did one long run or walk or whatever with the spine pack with kind of 8 kilos on my back to get used to that.
You see, what you just said there about getting the basics right, I mean, that's music to my ears, again, because that's something I'm keen to promote. And Stephen Seiler talks about a lot about the pyramid and everything. You know, if you can do all these, the rest of it's like icing on the cake. Mm. I think if you find what your sweet spot is, in like, okay, if you run to work and back to make life easier, or you cycle to work and back, that makes like easy. You're not having to find time for training sessions. You just do it because you have to get to work somehow. If there's a swim session twice a week that you can access that makes it really easy and it's part of your routine, if there's a Zwift session that you like doing on a Wednesday night because your mates are doing it, and if you go out with a group on a Sunday, you've got the basis of a regular training program that fits nicely into your life that you don't have to think about. Mm-hmm. And if you just commuted like you do, went to those 2 swim sessions, did the Zwift race and cycled with your mates at the weekend, and you did that for 12 weeks, you'd be incredibly fit without really having to do anything special. And I agree with you. I think people overthink, oh, I need to do this, and oh, should I do 5 by 6 or 6 by 5? Just get stuff done regularly and you'll be in a great place.
Yeah, and I think commuting is like, I did that when I went to work end of 2016 and kind of use my commute as training ever since then. But I used to swim before work, so sometimes I'd drive to the pool. But actually, since just before COVID, I haven't driven once. And that commute, it's like brushing my teeth. And it doesn't matter whether it's raining or snowing or hail or icy or whatever. I just know that I'm going to get to work, which means that an absolute minimum, I'll cycle 11 miles a day, and that I'll probably do that once a month, which means that every other day I'm in the hospital, I've at least run as a minimum 5.5 miles home. And most of the time when you're out the door, you end up extending it. And the other thing for me is, you know, it's my mental health space. Like after work, when you're knackered, I probably wouldn't run because you're exhausted. But actually, when you there is no way, I've got to get home. So unless I get a taxi or the bus, which I'm obviously not going to do, I'm going to have to run it. And that just gives me that kind of end of compartmentalization, process everything that's happened. And then when I'm at home, my kind of work's done and I can relax. So, yeah, if you can, and I guess it is hard if you live far away, but you can drive some of the way and then, you know, cycling the rest of the way or running or whatever. So I'd strongly recommend that.
There's a lot of ways around it, isn't there? And also, if the weather's not so good, if you're commuting, you haven't got really the option like, oh, it's raining, I'm not going out today. It's like, I've got to get to work. And we've been having an ongoing discussion on my Facebook group about whether commuting is just, should you record it as training or not? Is it junk miles? Most people are saying no, it's useful, but there's one or two. But Jack Maitland used to, I think he was working in Bradford. He'd get the train to the station in Bradford and then he would run to the college a mile and a half uphill, and then he would run back to the station in the morning, mile and a half downhill, as well as his other training. But he said, you know, and then I spoke to other people who cycled everywhere, and nearly all of them have said those times when I was commuting and doing all those little bits of filler were the years when I had some of my best performances as well. So I think there's definitely something to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it might be junk miles, but mental health is really important. And I think if you're running, you're running. And there's, you know, particularly if you're doing ultras, I think consistency is really, really important. And it's, you know, quite a lot of time I'd have a pack on my back as well. So it just felt like it all contributed. It didn't take any mental energy. And it was just part of my life.
When you entered for the event, Lucy, were you thinking, I just want to complete this and get around without, you know, damaging myself too badly? Or did you, you know, being a competitor, did you have aspirations for something greater than that?
No, I knew, so without being arrogant, I knew I could complete it. Like, you've got 7 days. I knew I could do 40 miles a day. And I could do that staying in 4-star hotels, having 3-course dinners for a lot less money than I could have done the spine race. So I wasn't, I was entering it to push myself. And I think for me, it was the unknown of what happened when you tried to go. The sleep bit was the only jigsaw piece that I couldn't get before the race, because it was, you can't get sleep deprivation. I'd done 100 miles, I'd done kind of 24 hours, but beyond that, you can't get that. So I was doing it to challenge myself. I wasn't doing it to race anyone else. I didn't expect to be near the front of the race. I think people tracking me were like, oh my God, Lucy's like just smashing it. She's going to try and win it. But actually that wasn't what I was doing. I was doing it to try and push myself. And the sleep thing was the bit that I just couldn't sleep in the aid stations. And that was ultimately my downfall. But we're 2-3 months down the line now. And when I finished and I was really close to doing something really special, actually. I really wasn't going to win it, but I was really close to doing something pretty special that not many women have done until the last 24 hours when it all went horribly wrong.
What was that, Lucy? That special thing?
It was just looking like it was going to be a really, really good performance. And then it all came undone. And I guess when I finished, I wasn't sure whether I'd be disappointed that it had been so close to being so good, and wasn't, or whether actually I'd look back and I'd think, well, I wasn't doing it to be competitive. I was doing it to challenge myself. And the fact that I had all that adversity at the end kind of gave me everything I wanted. And now 3 months down the line, I just feel so satisfied that I did push myself into a massive hole that I just about got out of. And that for me is what I was doing the spine race for. I think in a way I'd have been almost disappointed had I finished in a really good time and been like, well, that wasn't that hard, because that wasn't what I was doing it for.
I hope you're enjoying the show so far and learning a lot. If you aren't already a regular listener, I hope you feel you might come back. Please make sure to hit the subscribe button so you know whenever a new episode arrives. I publish these twice a week, ad-free, and with the mission of improving the health and performance of endurance athletes around the world. And to help me, I'd love it if you could share the episode with one person you think could benefit. If you have a couple more minutes, perhaps you could leave me a review on your chosen platform once you've finished listening to this episode. Okay, let's get back to the show. What was the adversity that, for those people who hadn't been following you, that you were talking about there in those last 24 hours?
Well, I guess, so running through the race, I set off, I covered the kind of first 24 hours or 30 hours or whatever, way quicker than I expected I was going to. And got to the Hawes, which is the second checkpoint. So that's 108 miles. I thought I'd get there at night time, but I actually got there at 1 o'clock in the afternoon or something. So it was kind of way ahead of schedule, and found myself unknowingly kind of in amongst the front women. There's one lady who's Claire Bamworth, who's just a different kind of kettle of fish. And then I didn't know. After that, it was the unknown. So I tried to sleep at Hawes, but I couldn't. It was the middle of the afternoon. I was just buzzing. And you kind of go into these checkpoints and you've had all this. I mean, to be fair, until that point, I was actually with a group of guys. So it's quite sociable. But after that, I was on my own. And it's really hard to sleep on demand, even if you're really tired. It's really hard. So I tried to sleep there, but I couldn't. So then I set off, and I knew that night was going to be the unknown. The second night was like the start of the unknown, and it was so exciting. But as the race went on, I think the two things that derailed me, my legs were fine. My feet were fine. But the first was my chest. So I got, it was super cold. I think it was like minus 14, was the coldest, but didn't go above zero most of the time. Like it literally didn't go above zero for most of the race. So I got really bad cold induced asthma, to the extent that I sounded like a 60 pack a day smoker. I'm not exaggerating. And I was kind of going up some of the hills, like heaving on my poles to catch my breath, stopping. So that was the first thing. And that I think kind of exacerbated the second thing, which was not being able to sleep in the checkpoints. So I think the cough when I lay flat got even worse. But alongside that, I'm not a good sleeper. And I just found it so hard to sleep in the checkpoint. So I had one good sleep at about 160 miles for an hour. I felt amazing. I planned to sleep a lot longer, but I felt amazing after that. Set off, it was maybe 9 o'clock in the morning. It's just like, God, how did an hour make you feel such a new person? And then after that, I just barely slept and I couldn't sleep. And it culminated in incredible sleep deprivation, to the extent that probably with about 30 miles to go, I started sleepwalking. And it was the middle of the night. It was, I don't know, minus 10, minus 12 degrees. And there was half of me, like the rational part of me was, there was a church with a marathon to go where you can, that they open up and sleep in. And I knew I just had to get to that church. I knew it was too cold to sleep on the trail. And I couldn't, because I'd been having kind of 5 minute, 10 minute power naps, which were so rejuvenating, like remarkably rejuvenating, but it was just too cold. I knew I couldn't let myself lie down and do that. Uh-huh. But the other half of me was just falling asleep, and falling asleep and walking the wrong way to where I was going. Uh-huh. So I'd wake up off the trail or back up the hill that I'd just come down. And it was the most terrifying thing I've ever had. Mm. I honestly couldn't work out. I remember it so, but it's my memory of it is so clear. And I remember trying to work out whether this was a nightmare about the spine race or whether it was a spine race. The only way I could work it out was firstly, I like shouted, wake up, and I could hear myself. And then I could see on my Garmin the red lines where I'd gone off the course. And I was like, bloody hell, I am actually sleepwalking. And that was the most terrifying, discombobulating experience I've ever had. And eventually I got to the final checkpoint and I was like a shell of myself. I was so disorientated. It was terrifying. And I didn't think they'd let me finish. But long story short, I ended up kind of going to the checkpoint. They then kicked me out because you only last half an hour there. And you know, literally kicked me out, because if I'd stayed, I would have been disqualified. Mm. Took me down to the church and I slept for 2.5 hours and then kind of stumbled my way to the finish after that. So it was, yeah, it went from, it was just terrifying, that last bit.
This thing about sleep deprivation, I've spoken to people who are doing these multi-day events where it's non-stop, one of which is the Transcontinental Bike Race, you know, from I'm working with a guy now who did that a couple of years ago, and he said actually his strategy was I was going to ride all day, and then wherever I was, when I got to the nearest town at say 11 o'clock at night, I was going to check into a hotel and sleep for 5 hours rather than keeping going. Some of the other guys did, but then they would just end up sleeping by the road or crashing because they, you know, sleep riding is far more dangerous than sleep walking. I remember talking to Alistair Brownlee about him doing the Badlands gravel race Sierra Nevada in Spain, and he said that I know I've got the bike fitness, but the sleep deprivation or handling lack of sleep is another factor that marks out the people who do these events and win them. Is how you cope with that and what strategy. He said I know I'm not very good with sleep deprivation, so
I actually think I was good with sleep deprivation because until I wasn't, and it's really interesting, like, having been there. Actually, had I finished the race in the time that Jasmine Paris had done it, you know, 20 hours quicker than what I did, I would have been fine on the hour and a half sleep that I'd had, because that was when it started to hit me at kind of 86 hours, 90, 88 hours. So it's almost like the quicker you do it, obviously the less sleep you need, but the amount you need, the longer it takes exponentially. Yeah. You can't just go, you know, an hour for 48 hours, 2 hours for 72, whatever. It kind of exponentially catches up with you. So if you tip over, say, 90 hours, you probably need, I don't know. And then if you tip over 100, you probably need another 6 hours or whatever.
So knowing that, then, if you did this or an event like it again, would you actually have a strategy for sleeping? Given that you've said it, you found it difficult in the checkpoints, what would you do? Would you be forcing yourself to stop by the side of the trail and saying, right, I'm going to have an hour here in my bivy bag regardless? I don't feel like I need it now, but I know I'll need it later, so I have to take it now.
No, I would, I think I would sleep when I needed it on the trail, because you have to carry all this stuff. And obviously, mm-hmm. if it's wet, it's a bit different. But actually, where you do have to carry all this stuff, so you may as well use it. And I think I think I was maybe in a busy part of the race, because there were the Challenger North, where I was caught up with all of those guys. So probably if I was 6 hours behind, the checkpoints would have been a lot quieter, maybe. But the checkpoints were so busy, and I just had no idea that it would be impossible for me to sleep on the bike. I think the chest was making it worse, but there were so many quiet bits, and we were so lucky with the weather. I know it was cold, but it was beautiful. And there were so many quiet hedgerows or like old barns where actually you could just have got your mat out, got your bivy bag out. You're in all the clothes anyway, mm-hmm. and just put your head down when you needed to, and probably had a really good hour's sleep. So if I ever did that again, I think I would plan to just go into the checkpoint, sort my feet out, mm-hmm. have some food, crack on, and then sleep on my own in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, I have seen that in the transcontinental races, that the folks don't stop at the checkpoints to sleep. They'll ride, go in there, do whatever they need to do admin wise, and then ride on a bit and sleep by the trail, probably for that very, I've wondered why they might do it, and that might be the answer to it. It's just that it's quieter and you can actually get your head down and actually not be disturbed as easily.
Yeah, I mean, most of the checkpoints have got beds, but they're in a dormitory, and there were so many people have this cough. So, and people are coming in and coming out, and then they're setting alarms, and doors are banging, and it's just crazy. And you've gone, the other thing is, you've gone from being in your own head, like the solitude was just, it was just incredible. I loved it. To suddenly everyone's bustling, and it's all quite stressful because you're trying not to lose your kit and get your kit sorted. And it's just not, for me, it just wasn't conducive to sleep. And there's probably a bit of me as well that, you know, I am competitive. And then you're lying there in bed and you're like, I'm not sleeping. I need to sleep. This is crazy. I need to sleep. Like, I've got 2 hours sleep. I need to sleep 2 hours. I'm wasting time. What am I doing? I'm not sleeping. Mm-hmm. And then I just give up and get up. But yeah.
You talked a little bit about equipment, about the poles. When you do marathon disable, there's a lot of stuff about what's the right kind of pack. I mean, I guess the right sort of pack is one that puts the equipment in and suits your particular stature, really. So is there any advice you could give somebody who was thinking about an event like that, or just take your time and find the pack that fits your back?
Yeah, I think you just have to find one that fits. And I tried several. So I think I would definitely have some spare capacity, because it's really helpful to be able to take food, extra food or spare layers or whatever. So, and also you don't want to be playing Jenga to try and get everything in. So I think I would have a little bit of spare capacity. I think the number one is comfort. And then things like, and actually I opted for comfort over this bit, but how you access your food, et cetera. Like, my side pockets were actually really hard to get in and out of. Which I think it's such a little thing, but when it's minus 14 and you're tired and it's an effort, you have to take your gloves off, etc. So then that probably meant that I underfueled. But for me, it was that the comfort, I found a pack that was comfortable, and that's what I went with. And I couldn't find one that was perfect, so I decided comfort was the most important thing.
And what did you do about footwear then? Because there's a myriad of different terrains you're going across. Did you go for running shoes? Did you go for walking shoes? Was it hybrid with trail shoes?
Yeah, no, I experimented with a few, and I opted for comfort. So I went with Hoka Speed Goats, which most people would say that is crazy for that terrain, but they were so comfortable. They never gave me any blisters. And I just, you know, I'd done loads of big days in them. And I just thought, do you know what, actually, maybe they've not got the best grip, but comfort has got to be the most important thing. So that was the decision that I went for. And I, you know, tried lots of things. And you will read, you go on the Facebook group and everyone's got their expertise or whatever. Mm-hmm. You just got to find what works for you.
Yeah. Is it just the grip, the reason why people don't like the Speed Goats then?
I don't know. I mean, I think the grip's okay. They're not great on slippy rocks, but they're okay on everything else. And you've got your poles. So yeah, I like them. They work for me.
It's a bit like finding the right mountain bike tires, right? Because sometimes you're on a dry trail, sometimes you're on mud. You're not going to have a tire that's brilliant on all of those. And the same with footwear. And if you've got something that's got great grip and really good off-road, once you get onto the tarmac, and there's probably a bit of that as well, then it becomes a bit uncomfortable.
Yeah, and I think, you know, not having blisters, like you can't put money on that. And yeah, I think because the ground was so hard, actually, the shoes, because they're so cushioned, actually were the right choice for that. Might have been a bit different if it was really muddy. But yeah, again, you know, I just ignored all the advice and I thought, well, what have I done? I've done all these days of point to points and these are the most comfortable shoes that I found. So I'm going to go with that.
You alluded a little bit there, Lucy, to being able to get your food easily. What was your nutrition and hydration strategy for an event like that, if you have a strategy, or is it just eat as much as you can when you can?
Yeah, so I, like with all the point to points, I'd actually been really good at eating and was just eating normal food. But I did struggle, particularly the first 48 hours, actually. And I just felt sick most of the time. And the first bit of food that I enjoyed was maybe probably about 54 hours in. I got a bought, so it was the only bit of food that I bought, a sausage sandwich in what was it called? Anyway, Dufton. And it was just, I was like, oh my God, this is the first bit of food that I've enjoyed. So yeah, I carried way too much because I didn't realize that there were so many people out on the trails giving stuff around. So if I did it again, I'd probably carry less food. And I'd carry more savory stuff because the bits they're giving out is kind of cakes and chocolates and things. A good tip that someone gave me actually just a couple of weeks before the race, which was a game changer, was take a kind of expedition meal that you can heat up, that you can just put hot water in. So I had one of those in my bag each time. The best thing that I took was, it sounds so silly, but cheesy mashed potato that you can just add water to. And that, I remember having that at the bottom of Hadrian's Wall, and it's just magic. But I definitely, with hindsight, underfueled. And I think there were two reasons. Firstly, it was so cold. So it's a real effort to eat anything. To get stuff out, you have to take your gloves off. To eat it, everything's frozen, and it was just nothing really tasted that good. You know, frozen anything doesn't taste good because it was so cold. Your water bottles were frozen solid, like two hours your water bottle was frozen solid. But the other reason, I think, was that time would just go, and all of a sudden you think, well, what have I done for the last 4 hours? Like, where have I been? Where are you? Just, you know, and then you think, well, I haven't eaten or drunk anything before. And you couldn't drink because your water bottles were frozen. So, again, I'd probably try and set some kind of alarm so that I made sure I ate every hour or whatever.
Yeah, I've found that something like the Marathon des Sables, I took freeze-dried meals, ones that have been specially prepared. And you know what I ended up with most times that I found the things that I could really stomach? Pot noodles, because they had carbohydrates, they had salts, they had fats in. They had everything. Yeah. They were, there's probably got a lot of things that you wouldn't normally recommend, but there's a point when healthy eating goes out the window and it's about fueling survival, really, isn't there? And I think you've got to have things that are palatable and are easy to get down and are not going to come back up.
Oh, yeah. And that mashed potato is better than any of the, you know, expedition meals that I had. So I would definitely be doing doing mashed potato going forwards.
you probably find that you're the face of the quick mashed
face
potato.
Cheesy mash.
One of the things I've heard about the spine, I mean, is it the Pennine Way?
Yeah, Pennine Way.
So the Pennine Way is a well-trodden trail, except that actually some of it's not that easy to find sometimes, and particularly if you've spent the last half an hour wandering around in circles or walking the wrong way and you sort of hallucinating a bit. And if some of it's 3 foot under snow or you're in the middle of a blizzard. What sorts of challenges did you have with navigation on the event?
So I would love to know how much time I wasted wandering off the trail, like far too much. So I think you have to carry a handheld navigation device as well as a watch. And I just took my bike Garmin to tick the box because I knew I'd be using poles and I didn't want to spend £600 on a handheld device. So I was navigating off my watch, and I think I'm not a particularly good navigator, but I do think there are real benefits from having a good handheld device. So I think my Garmin did freeze quite a lot in the cold weather. So it wasn't, and I think Damien, I do remember listening to a podcast before, and Damien Hall had switched to something else. So I think it is maybe a thing. And there was one point in the blizzard where it completely froze, like just completely died. And I was in the blizzard on the top of Crossfell in the dark with no idea where I was. Literally, it was no idea where I was. It was terrifying. But yeah, my navigation was poor. It is a relatively easy trail to navigate. So it's a lot of it is signposted. There are bits where it's much harder to navigate, particularly in snow. So if you can't see the path, because Crossfell, for example, landmarks, there were no landmarks because I had probably, 10 meters visibility maximum, absolute maximum. It was dark. All the paths were covered in snow and there was a blizzard around me. So that was, that was impossible. You probably did need to be able to navigate better. I would love, and sometimes you just make stupid mistakes where, your Garmin might be catching up and you end off route and then you don't maybe pick up on it. And then you just end up, there was one point at the bottom, and I ended up off Hadrian's Wall. I'm like, how have I come off Hadrian's Wall? What am I doing? And that's half an hour. You've got to then go back and rejoin it. So when you're tired, you make bad decisions. I guess that's where actually a lot of runners do it together. So they kind of group up. And I think that's, I really love the solitude, and I have no regrets. I did after the first 100 miles, I was on my own. But I think there are definite benefits from being with people in terms of just kind of spotting bad navigation, etc.
I've seen that on adventure races where people are making navigational errors when they're tired. Or what you get when you're in a team, for instance, is you come to a junction where it's not easy to tell on the map or the course route where you should be going right or left. And so then you spend 10 minutes with one person in the team saying, I think we should go this way, and three saying go that way. And that's that one incident doesn't cost you much. But if you multiply that by 5 or 6 times across a 30-mile cycle route, all of a sudden you're really on the cutoffs. The other thing I've also seen with tiredness is not just getting navigation errors, but when you stop and you take some stuff out of your pack and you forget to pick something up and put it back, or you leave the zip open. So as you're proceeding along the route, bits are dropping out as you're jogging along or going across rough terrain and you've not noticed. And then you go to get your map or you something and it's not there, but it's too late.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there was one point on the last 26 miles. So that was after the kind of sleepwalking, and I was still so sleep deprived, and I was so shell shaken by it. But I was getting by. It was a glorious sunny day, and I was just napping whenever I needed to. And my Garmin had sent me off the course, and I lay down. I was like, I need to nap, and I just wouldn't take my bag off. I just lie down. Close my eyes. And I had been setting alarms, but this time I hadn't set an alarm. And I woke up, I was like, oh my God, I need to go. And the Garmin was pointing left. And I knew that there was no path, and I knew that there was no bit across open moorland. For some reason, I just decided I'd follow the line of my Garmin, even knowing that was nonsense. It wasn't doing that. And anyway, just, again, you're like, why did I make that decision? It was such a stupid decision. I knew that it was all on paths. But yeah, your brain does crazy things when you're that sleep deprived.
This whole thing about cognitive function always makes me think about when you talked earlier about junior doctors doing these super long shifts and thinking, I'm not sure if I'd really want somebody to be working out whether I need a small dose of morphine or this dose of morphine when they haven't had any sleep for 2 days.
Do you know, I remember very vividly, actually, one of my first night shifts. I remember, so we do these blood gas tests where you take the blood from someone's artery, and it's to look at the oxygen levels to work out what the cause of their breathing problems is. And I remember very clearly talking to this guy, and you get this tiny little, like a paper receipt printout, and it gives you these numbers. And in any normal day, it's very easy to work out what's going on. And we were both looking at it going, I've literally no idea what this means. It's like reading a different language. I remember it so clearly. It's like one of the first night shifts.
when you learn to scuba dive, if you do the advanced certification, when you go down to 30 meters, they give you this little test where you do some very simple arithmetic on the boat. And then you go down 30 meters and they get you to do it again. And if you're starting to get this nitrogen narcosis, you just can't do the sums. You're just looking at 2 + 2. And like, it's like, I know the answer to that, but what, I don't know what it is actually. And it all becomes really, really quite stressful.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I look back at some of the decisions and you think, in no normal world would I have ever made those decisions. But funnily enough, that was Bex got a video of me before the start and said, you know, what are your biggest fears? And they were main stupid decisions because I was so tired, which I did, and not being able to sleep. And they were the two ones that kind of came, and digging a hole, which I did.
Not one to sleep in, though. You talked about the navigation. Is there any requirement to be able to navigate with a compass then, like there is on some outdoor races?
No, you have to carry a compass, and you have to be able to get a grid reference on your Garmin, but on your handheld, but that's it.
Right. I mean, that whole thing you talk about using a bike computer is, as long as it's got directional stuff on it, is it really any different from a handheld Garmin that's meant for people going walking?
I think there's definite benefit from having something with a screen with OS Maps on. Mm-hmm. So you can actually see the contours, and because my watch is great, but you only get a little kind of view of it, and sometimes you don't know whether you're going up or down or what have you. So you have to carry maps, but there's no way in any world that anyone's going to get out a map in the middle of a blizzard and like map and compass and work out where you go. You're just, you know, no matter how good you are, you're not going to do that.
Well, that's right. The map would be papier-mâché and blown away within 5 minutes, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, so
if you can actually fold it up and do some origami in a 50 mile an hour wind.
Yeah.
Lucy, I know you've got other things to do this afternoon, so wrapping up then, I'm sure when people listen to this and they hear your story, they'd be like, oh, I wonder if I could do that. What advice would you have for somebody who's thinking about taking on the spine challenge?
I think the biggest thing, and it goes with any challenge, is know your why. It took me a long time to know whether I actually really, really wanted to do it and what my reasons for doing it were. And I think that's the biggest thing, because if you do, you know, whether it's an Ironman or an ultra or something really long like the spine, there are going to be patches where it is really tough. And that's where knowing why you're doing it is so important. So that's the first thing. Make sure you're doing it for the right reasons and you really want to do it. And then I guess just take a step back and think, okay, what do I need to do to be able to do it? And for me, the training bit was the easy. That's the bit that I loved. But the kit faff, oh my God, that was a nightmare. I hated it. Absolutely hated it. I just like going out and running and experimenting with that kit. And even things like, how are you going to charge everything? And it turns out I have far too many spare batteries. It's actually really easy to charge stuff. But, you know, there's all that logistical. It's a good 3 hours of thinking, okay, so what am I going to carry? What if my head torch battery dies? What if my watch battery dies? How am I then going to charge it? What if there's no charging point at that checkpoint? How much power in my power banks? You know, I did do it quite thoroughly. So I'd explored every... The only bit that I couldn't do was asleep. For me, the training was the easy bit. All of that was the hard bit. But I knew that that was part of... I had to do that, which is, I guess, when you're preparing, I was like, okay, my why, I'll be so annoyed if I get out there, my head torch dies and I can't recharge it.
Mm-hmm. So knowing your why, so what was the other one then?
Understanding your why, and then I guess take a step back and think, what do I need to do to get myself in the best chance of finishing it? And I don't know where it came to me, but for me, the jigsaw for this just worked really well, and they're all the pieces. I was just in my head going around and collecting the pieces. And one of the last ones was the ice and snow. And obviously you need ice and snow to get that. But there was a day and I basically cancelled everything and went out to the peaks. I was like, right, I'm going to get that jigsaw piece and just know that I could deal with ice and, you know.
I think that's a good thing for any big event like this, isn't it? If you were standing on the start line, you don't want to be having regrets like, oh, I should have practiced that while I had the chance. You want to be able to have a mental checklist of, right, I've done that, I've experienced that. And like you say, the sleep deprivation, I've spoken to a number of people, including sleep research experts, as I'm sure you have, and, you know, submitting or exposing yourself to sleep deprivation isn't necessarily a healthy thing to do anyway. And just because you can work, do something through the night, there's not really an adaptation to that. So you don't get any better at it just because you've done it a few times.
But you learn, I think you learn, I learned so much in that.
Yes, maybe there's a learning effect. Yeah.
Yeah, you can only learn by doing it. But yeah, I think I stood on that start line and I knew I'd done everything I could possibly have done without ruining my life. But I knew I'd done everything I could possibly have done to give myself the best chance of getting to that finish line. And that knowledge is so powerful when it gets tough and you think, okay, I've been here. I've done this. I've had this niggle before. I've knowing that you've done everything you can do. And that was my motto in triathlon, knowing that you've done everything you can do.
Do you remember that we recorded a podcast with the lady who you'd done the swim course with?
Helen.
We recorded, yeah, you and Helen and I recorded a podcast a while back. And I remember in that, we were talking about this anxiety thing that people have with open water swimming, you know, particularly if you go to somewhere like Ironman Wales and it's rough, you probably want to have gone swimming in some rough weather where you can, just so that when you see it like that, at least you can think, I've done this before, I've got this. And that sticks with me. So you've almost put those same lessons into a different environment, haven't you?
Well, interesting you say that, actually. So Helen's a sports psychologist and she supported me when I was a pro. And we then, which Helen wrote it, I just shared my stories, but created Iron Mind, which is a sports psychology course. So it's a 6-week kind of videos that you do with workbooks, training your mind to get ready for an Ironman, but it's equally applicable for any endurance event. And I actually went back and did that before the spine.
Okay.
Because obviously it was a long time since we created it, but I found that really helpful. And it starts about kind of defining your why and reflecting what you've done and problem solving, and then getting you excited and getting that belief ready that you can do it. So I did that week by week going into it. And again, that was a little bit about, okay, I'm going to do everything, including my mind. I'm going to make sure I've got my head in the right place. I found that really helpful. So I know it's a bit of promotion, but you brought it in, but it is a really good kind of very simple psychology course to kind of get your head in the right place for big events.
Oh, no problem promoting it, Lucy. That was a good podcast, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. I mentioned earlier that my wife's doing an ultra event, and she had a question for you. Like, when you're doing a multi-day event like this, do you get DOMS before? No, not before, during the event? You know, if you've had a break for a couple of hours and you start again, do you notice that, or does it not really set in until you've finished?
Oh, this is fascinating. So niggles come and niggles go. But you only find that out if you run through them. And okay. they do, I had sore quads. I thought I'd done something to my anterior tibial tendon. I had this, I had that, and they just come, and then you keep going and they go through them. So I think that's the biggest thing I would. And you learn that if you do enough multi-day event, you know, kind of multi-day kind of backup stuff. But niggles come and niggles go. So remember that when you get a niggle. A few hours later, you won't be thinking about that. And you can only think of one thing hurting at once. So if something else starts hurting, then that's a cure for the other one.
And how much do you think is that's muscular, and how much is that is neural, do you think?
I don't know. I guess there's something about the information kind of causes the pain, and then the information heals or does what it needs to do. Or maybe your brain just forgets about it. I don't know. But you can definitely, I don't know, just try and experience two pains at once. I don't think it's possible.
You mentioned Jasmine Paris has been your inspiration for this. Obviously, around the same time, or just after you'd finished that, there's been a lot in the papers about Jasmine and the Barclay marathons. Courtney DeWalter seems to be setting the ultra running, the marathon world on fire with her amazing results, not just winning those, but her positions, right in the front of the entire field. What is it about females and ultra distance events, and particularly as the distance gets longer, do you think?
There's a really interesting podcast that I listened to I'll try and find it and send it over. But because there are events where women win races outright, people like mm-hmm. women, the longer it goes, women are more equal. They're not actually faster, but I think the evidence suggests that they prepare better. So, and they don't enter races unless they think they've done everything they need to finish. So okay. men are much more gung-ho of like, yeah, I'll do 100 miles and then not putting the work in. Whereas women won't sign up to enter until they feel that they've actually done justice. So women aren't faster than men, but we do kind of prepare better. And I think Jasmine and Courtney DeWalter, they are just exceptional athletes. I don't know either of them, but both of them inspire me in different ways. Courtney DeWalter just seems to have this huge love of just kind of trains mm-hmm. very similar to, like, I listen to her and she just kind of, I go out and sometimes I run, I don't know whether I'm doing 1 hour or 4 hours. I'm like, yep, that's the same. I go out and I don't know if I'm going to run the hill hard or if I'm going to walk it. I'm like, exactly the same. Mm. I love that kind of just get out there and have fun. And Jasmine, I think, is the most undersung role model that anyone can have. She's, you know, she's so humble. She's so tenacious. She's a vet. She's a mum. She doesn't really do self-promotion. She does it because she realizes she has to, because it's the only way people can be inspired by her. And yeah, I just think she's the most incredible person. Much respect for her.
I read a great interview with her where she even turned down shoe sponsorship because she didn't want people to be buying shoes unnecessarily because of her achievements and thinking about, you know, just the whole ecology and all of that stuff. And I know it's been a difficult thing for her to balance, hasn't it, being this green athlete and then still traveling out to America and people are calling her out for it, like, well, how did you get out there then, you know, did you sail out there or something? But
they've founded, so her and Damien Hall and probably someone else founded the Green Runners.
Yes.
And I'm actually thinking of joining it. So it's a really good concept. As I don't believe in jumping on the bandwagon, but their kind of premise, as I understand it, is no one's perfect.
No.
But actually awareness is really important and everyone can do something. And I guess, like, for me, I do the commuting, but rather than joining, you don't pay a big membership fee, but you make a pledge for something that you're going to do to make a difference. And that can be how you eat or what you wear or how you travel or even just speaking mm-hmm. out about it. And I think that's a really helpful concept because no one's perfect. And you can't go and live in a hovel and never do anything just because you want to protect the environment. Mm-hmm. But everyone can do something. So yeah, I really like the concept, and the more I reflect on it, the more I think it's not jumping on a bandwagon. It's really powerful. So mm-hmm. yeah, a bit of promotion for something I'm not even part of yet.
Well, we'll promote it anyway. And then by the time people get round to looking at it, you'll be an ambassador, I'm sure. So is ultra running going to be your thing going forward, Lucy? Are we going to see you pushing Courtney DeWalter a little bit? Or are we going to see you attempting the Barclay Marathons?
Oh, my God. If anyone could see me run down a hill, they would just be in hysterics because I'm so bad at it. But no, I do love adventures and I love the challenge. And yeah, I am doing a couple this year, not really as races, but more as a kind of justification to keep doing what I'm doing. You know, who knows if I'll go back to the spine. I feel like there's a jigsaw piece that I haven't yet got. So mm-hmm. maybe that will be the draw to try and get that sleep jigsaw piece. But maybe it'll be the spine, maybe it'll be something else. But it's really not about racing other people. It's about kind of experimenting with myself and the process. It sounds such a cliche, but the discovering, mastering something new. And I think that's what I'm really enjoying because I'm so bad at it. I know you wouldn't believe that having seen the spine, but where I started to where I am now, it's that's what I'm liking, like that jigsaw.
It's a discussion I've had with a couple of other people. I listened to watched a documentary about Kilian Jornet, and quite a few people, and he talked about the fact that he he's not really bothered about the racing. It's the training he does. He almost races so he can train and so it can justify his training. And he gets out there and just like you were talking about, he'll, I don't know whether I'm going to climb that mountain or go up it twice today, but it's there. And so I'll just see how I feel. I wonder whether, I know how much you like racing, and but I know how much you like having fun as well. And I wonder whether the preparation and the having fun on the way is just almost in reverse. You prefer that more than the racing.
Absolutely. And I don't, there is a bit of me that wishes I wasn't, I mean, I was so far off the lady that won it in the end, but there is a bit of me that wishes I wasn't near the front, because I don't want to be competitive. I don't want to be, I'm not doing it. I've had my career being a competitive athlete. I'm doing it for myself. But the reality is in smaller races, I probably will be, you know, vaguely near the front, and I trying to find a line to walk where I don't get sucked in and keep that adventure and for myself. I think it's something I really want to make sure that I get that right.
Well, Lucy, I'm already excited about our next podcast conversation to hear about your future adventures. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your trip to Mallorca. I hope the weather's a bit warmer and sunnier than it is in the UK right now. And I do look forward to seeing you perhaps coming to have a chat with us at the Outlaw if you're passing by in Nottingham sometime. That would be
I'm always there every year, Simon.
Well, please make sure you come and say hello and we can grab a little word with you while we're on the mic.
I will. I was there last year. Yeah, I love it. I literally live 3 minutes away, so very easy.
All right. Lucy, it's been a pleasure as always. Thank you again for sharing your adventures and take care.
Thanks so much for having me on, Simon. Thank you.
Thanks again to Lucy for being my guest on the show this week. During the podcast, Lucy made an excellent point about keeping things simple and finding the right fit for your training with your lifestyle. I think the bottom line for me on that is don't worry too much about what other people are doing. Make it all work for you. Now, to make sure you don't miss any of our future episodes, please go to iTunes or any of the other podcast platforms that you might use. Search for High Performance Human Triathlon Podcast and then click on the subscribe button. And once you finish listening to this, especially if you liked it, please could you share the episode with just one person that you think might benefit? And what would be even more awesome is if you've got a couple more minutes, maybe you could leave me a review on your chosen platform. And that would be great. Finally, make sure you check out those show notes for links to all the items that Lucy and I talked about in the podcast, including some of those really interesting blogs that Lucy's written about the state of the NHS at the moment. Okay, that's all for this week. In another 7 days, I will have another great guest, and I hope you'll be able to join me. So please remember to check out those show notes for all the links I mentioned, and enjoy the rest of your week. Happy training.